I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro, popping in to say we've edited this podcast a little for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Early October is reliably one of the most picturesque times of year in our region. Us humans love us some fall foliage and sweater weather. Birds, on the other hand, couldn't really care less. Many local species are getting out of Dodge and migrating south for the winter. Today, it is our annual Fall Bird Show. We'll talk about all those birds heading south and the special species you can spot right now in our region. I'm joined in the studio today by the bird diva, Bridget Butler. She's a naturalist and birder, as well as the executive director of the Friends of Northern Lake Champlain. It's a nonprofit working to reduce water pollution from runoff. Bridget, you're a sight for sore eyes.
Oh,
it's always
yes.
So great to have you in the studio.
It's so good to perch here once again. It's such a cozy home. I'm like, oh, I get to go back again. Yes.
I know.
And you know what? It's just like the birds migrating. Spring, fall,
fall. Yeah. Mm. You're like our own little bird.
Oh.
Bridget, you already have your bird book open.
Yeah.
I know you've been scribbling notes before we started. Where fall migration, where do we want to start?
Oh, my gosh. Like, where do you start?
Ducks, okay. Sparrows, raptors.
Yeah, like all of it. I think the biggest thing that I love about the Fall Bird Show is it reminds us that it's not over.
Mm.
Like, our connection and our relationship with birds doesn't have to stop because of migration. And I think it's a really great time to not only reflect on all the, like, exciting things that happened about the summer, which I was doing as I was driving down here, but also think about, like, what's to come. And you just mentioned, like, a set of different birds that we can start to enjoy through the fall season. And so, you know, really, when we get into August and September, it starts with, we start saying goodbye to our warbler friends, all those little delightful, like, eye candy birds, like scarlet tanagers and blackburnian warblers that need to be somewhere else. We put our gardens to bed, we're starting to think about, too, how can we still provide food and shelter and all of that for the birds that are moving through. I think that's what I love, too, is that each day that I step outside, there may be something a little bit different. And although it's not as riotous as the spring migration, right, it has this, like, subtle softness to it.
Mm.
And so I think the thing I've been enjoying the most right now are sparrows, right? These little brown birds about the size of chickadees, and we have all kinds of different species here in Vermont. And we're saying goodbye to some of them, right? Song sparrow is going to leave. White-throated sparrows are going to be moving through. But we also get to say hello to some winter sparrows that are going to be hanging out with us, like American tree sparrow. And then we have, like, the fox sparrow. Like, okay, fox sparrow, I cannot help but go into, like, Jimi Hendrix songs, right? When I start thinking about fox sparrow, this is like a chunkier, larger sparrow. So if you're familiar with
song
sparrow. Yeah, big boy sparrow. Rusty red, really kind of dapper looking. And the time that we get to see them is during spring and fall migration. So these are these very special windows that when we pause and we take a moment to kind of slow down and really be present on the land and open up our senses, we can have these experiences with a variety of different birds like all of our sparrow friends.
Mm. Well, I see that your book is open to hummingbirds. And we got email from a listener named Jan about a hummingbird spotted with some very exact information. Jan writes, on Sunday, October 6th, I was 1 hour from pulling my feeder for the season when I saw a hummingbird at 2:51 p.m.
Yes.
I immediately prepared fresh nectar in a clean feeder. The hummingbird has been with me throughout today, Thursday, October 10th. As of this writing, he has visited the feeder at least 6 times. I'm certain he'll be here another day. He's healthy, alert, stays close to the feeder. I feel like he is aware of the hurricanes in the south and is delaying his flight home for the winter. Does that sound reasonable for migratory hummingbirds in the Northeast?
Oh my gosh, there's so much to unpack there. Okay, so first, this is one of the things that happens during the fall. We start to, because we form these relationships with birds, especially hummingbirds, where they can come so close to us because we put up feeders, right? And we know they migrate. We start to worry when we hit October. We're like, oh my gosh, why are you still here? You should be leaving. Do I leave the feeder out? Do I take it in? Am I going to keep the hummingbirds here? Do I have that power? And really, The hummingbirds know what they need.
Okay. Right? So they're not staying because they still have the hummingbirds.
Exactly.
Out.
Right.
Okay.
So they're feeding on a variety of things. This is also the time of year when that's plentiful with insects. So you got lots of protein on the landscape as well. I tend to watch when the jewelweed, it's like this little orange flower that has those really fun seeds that explode when you touch them. So jewelweed is one of the last spring or fall wildflowers that we'll have on the landscape that's actually nectar-based, which is a great food source. So when we get to those first frosts and that plant gets wiped out, that's when I start to think, oh, I should start to see the hummingbirds leave. So it kind of coincides with the food resources that are available. So having ruby-throated hummingbirds hang out here through this time of year, especially when the weather is good, it's still warm, we don't have a lot of rain, we haven't gotten the first frost yet, is okay, right? They know what they're doing. I find it fascinating that she is like, could it be that they can tell that there's a hurricane going on? And we do know that animals can respond to weather in a different way than we do. They feel like the pressure changes differently than we do. They kind of connect with the light availability as well, right? So that's another cue for them. So I don't know that I could say for sure that the hummingbirds are like keyed in with the hurricanes, but I do know that those feelings of air pressure and temperature may be allowing that bird to make a decision to stick around a little bit longer.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Jen, thank you so much for telling us about your little hummingbird friend.
Right. We were talking about at this time of year too, and when we have rare bird sightings, and one that I got really excited about. So this was back. This was like the beginning of September. Speaking of hummingbirds, right? Keep your eye out for other species. Here we have ruby-throated hummingbird, but sometimes we get some other ones that pop up. And a person from Montpelier sent me a bunch of pictures in September. Thank you for the pictures and the video because it made it so easy. And there was this larger, more robust hummingbird that was a metallic-y green all throughout.
Wow.
Almost like tiger beetle green color, right? And I got really excited because I was like, wow, I've never seen a hummingbird like that before. And it was visiting their feeders. So they were curious about who it might be. And as we looked it up and figured it out, it turns out it was a Mexican violet ear, which is a medium-sized hummingbird that's normally found in central Mexico and Nicaragua. And we only have about 4 records of them in Vermont. So sometimes birds get blown off course, right? And we're talking about hurricanes coming through right now. Hurricane season often can be, this is weird to say, especially with all the people that are hurting and suffering from those storm events right now. Birders get excited about them because sometimes birds blow into different regions that we don't get to experience normally. Yeah. So this may just have been a bird that was like off track. And the folks that were seeing it in their yard did all these great things. They reached out to some professionals, they took pictures, they took video, they wrote notes down. And what they did is they submitted it to the Vermont Rare Birds Records Committee, which I'm a member of. And this is the time of year when the Rare Birds Record Committee is reviewing different sightings that have come in throughout the year. And it's a way for us to kind of track differences in changes, in differences of distribution of rare birds that show up across the landscape at different times. And it's a really fun time for me to like fine tune my observation skills. And what these folks did so well was write down what they were noticing and observing about this bird and making comparisons to ruby-throated hummingbird in order to kind of document what they were seeing. Super fabulous and cool. So lots of fun with hummingbirds this year. And I just want to thank the folks in Montpelier for taking care of that bird, doing that documentation and giving us a report on it.
Wow, that is pretty magical.
Yeah, super cool.
Wow. Well, let me read a couple emails here. We've gotten a million, as we always do when you're on, Bridget. Sally from Burlington writes, while camping at Brighton State Park in Island Pond a few weeks ago, I was treated to the song of the hermit thrush, Vermont's state bird, as you know. And what a beautiful song it is. The next morning, one hermit thrush visited our campsite, walking along the edge of the woods, maybe looking for breakfast. First time I've heard the song or seen this wonderful bird in person.
Oh my gosh.
Lovely. Thanks for writing in, Sally.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. You know, and hermit thrushes, actually all of our thrushes tend to be pretty like secretive, I feel like, during the summer breeding months and when they're caring for their families throughout the summer. And and they get quieter, right? But at this time of year, it's almost like during migration, they're a little bit bolder. They're a little bit more on the edges of habitats looking for food sources. And we get this second chance to see them and have experiences with them like she did in Brighton State Park. Wow. Super cool.
Let's go to Richard, who's calling in from West Fairley. Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Bridget, Michaela, happy bird day. I spotted a very large bird a week or so ago. It was flying about treetop level, and it was a very dark color. I wouldn't call it black, but I wouldn't call it brown either. And the unique thing about it was that it had a square-type shape on its tail that was white. And I Googled it, and it said, and showed me pictures, and it looked exactly like it, said it was a northern herring eagle. And I read the whole thing on it, and it says that they're a coastal eagle, but their range is from Quebec to Florida. But I had never seen one. Have you?
That's really interesting. So Michaela was laughing at me because I got really excited.
You kind of did a little cheer fist bump.
I was like, woo. So as you were describing the bird, I got really excited when you described, and this is beautiful, right, description, that square patch above the tail on the backside of the bird. And so in my experience, when I see that in a raptor, what I think of, and this is almost what you said, but you added eagle on the end. So there is a bird in Vermont that's called a northern harrier that is that common field mark that we use to identify that bird is that white rump patch. And they do, there's two kind of what we plumages to them. So that we have like the gray ghost, which is very pale across the back, and then that white patch stands out. And then you have a darker version of the bird as well. So I would bet that is what you've seen. I have not heard, and it just because I haven't heard of it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I have not heard of a northern harrier eagle. And as I'm sitting here flipping through my field guide, I'm trying to like double check and see if that bird exists.
You flip. I'm going to read an email from Jamie in White River Junction, who wanted to let us know that they have seen a black vulture stop on their telephone pole to dry its wings. Also lots of Carolina wrens.
Super.
Did I give you enough time to flip?
Yeah, you did. Okay. So the two eagles that we tend to have showing up here in Vermont are the golden eagle and the bald eagle. I think you probably saw a northern harrier when you were out there, just based on your description and where you saw it.
Are they that big, though? I mean, this bird was like 3 or 4 feet across the wingspan.
So the other,
it was large.
So the other piece that we can start to think about it, when you start to refer to size, is think about bald eagles that may be in that juvenile state and haven't quite developed the fully white tail, but there is white plumage starting to come in along that backside. And I think if you pop open a field guide, you'll see on that bald eagle that on a mature bald eagle, there's like a little sliver that kind of extends across that lower back of white from the tail. And as we have those immature bald eagles coming into that full plumage, there may have that look of that square patch and then a dark tail and a dark body.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Richard.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I love when you get in detective mode.
I know. It's so fun to start to break things down. And, you know, and this goes back to like the more detail that you can provide and the more you can get into the description and tie it into habitat and the place that you are and then the time of year, right? There's all these layers. And yeah, so it is kind of like being a detective.
Or be like Jared and give us an exact timestamp
for
the spotting. we got an email that, where did it just go? Okay, here we go. Mark emailed us and wants to know if you have heard about this population explosion of ring-necked pheasants in central Vermont. Mark writes, I know they are escaped birds from some dog training facilities, but they seem to have exploited a niche and are now everywhere. It seems they're here to stay. Your thoughts, oh great bird diva.
Oh my gosh. I have not heard this story yet, and I'd be really curious to learn more about where they're popping up, right? I think, and I'm going to jump into a whole other group of animals, but I think about that lynx that's being spotted around the state.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so what I immediately go to is how could we crowdsource the community to like share sightings and like map where those are. So we could get an idea of how many different individuals there might be and where they're hanging out. And then he's saying like they're exploiting a niche in that area. So what is it about that area that's allowing them to survive? I think the other interesting piece here is as we have milder winters and things like that, birds that we would normally see not be able to make it through the winter that are wild or escapee birds are able to kind of make it through. I think of the sandhill cranes that we have around the state. We have a couple different breeding pairs around the state and how long they linger now because the weather doesn't change enough to create that drive in them to be like, yeah, we got to leave. This is not going to work out for us if there's like 7 feet of snow here.
Yeah, I think that's a trend I've noticed. You know, we've been doing this together for a couple of years now, Bridget, and more people write in before this show and saying, I'm seeing this bird lingering much longer than it used to. What's going on?
Yeah, and that's a great, you know, this is a great opportunity to keep a little journal. Like I brought a little notebook today. You keep a little notebook by your window or in your car. It's a great way to just mark down when you're seeing and hearing things and then having something to compare it back to.
Yeah.
In successive years.
Yeah. Let's go right back into the phones. We have Michael calling from Windsor. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hello, Bridget. This is Michael. I'm calling you from the Windsor grasslands in Windsor, Vermont, where we have northern harriers every year. And some years they stay and raise a family, but not this year. I had a bird observation that demonstrated to me the wisdom of crows, and then I wanted to ask you about a bird program that, and if you knew if it still existed. So social insects like the stinging insects, like the hornets and yellow jackets and all, their populations are the greatest at this time of year, at the end of the summer. And I saw an interesting thing the other day on Hunt Road as I was driving to the grasslands. I saw a crow. It looked like it dislodged a bald-faced hornet nest from some trees and landed on the road and split. And the crow proceeded to feed on whatever was in there, probably the larvae, because I imagine the adults left. But I'm going to imagine that the crow knew that this was the time of year that it would get its greatest number of morsels, and so that was just an interesting thing for me to see.
Well, wait, Michael, stay with us, but I want to hear Bridget your thoughts.
So, did you pull over and watch for a little bit?
Yeah, I did. I did, and I was concerned. I thought the adults might be there, so I rolled the windows up and all, but they were gone.
And, smart.
I think, you know, I love these opportunities to pause and watch interactions between different animal beings, right? So you saw this opportunity and had all these curiosities about are the adults going to be there? What could the crow be feeding on? I'd be worried, like, is the crow going to get stung? But then I'm thinking bald-faced hornets, that might be like a tasty little morsel if you can get past being stung. And then you bring up the larva that could be in that, and I'm losing the word for it now. What is it? It's like the the hive, but the nest. Yes, there we go. Jeez, Bridget.
Not a word to forget.
Not a word bird to diva. Forget is the bird diva. To kind of pick apart the nest for the larva, because that's going to be a huge protein resource. And just as we were just talking a minute or so ago with the hummingbirds, thinking about the abundance of insects on the landscape right now, we have a great opportunity to watch how birds take advantage of that abundance. And you did just that, Michael.
Michael, briefly, what was the organization you were wondering about?
There used to be, I don't know if it still exists, it was a program that was sponsored by the Smithsonian, and it was called Bridging the Americas. And my seventh grade students participated in it, and I thought it was wonderful. And if it still existed, I'd like to encourage other teachers to do it. And if it doesn't, I'm sad, and I'd like somebody to
bring
resurrect
it. Yeah, you're like, bring that back.
Are you familiar with what it was?
I am. I have heard about that program, and this is a really beautiful program where it's connecting, right? We think of a lot of these migratory birds as our birds, but they have these dual lives in other parts of the world, including Central and South America. And the other brilliant thing here, too, within this program is connecting those communities of people that live in those different areas and our common shared experience with those birds. I, too, would be really sad if that program's not going on. I feel pretty confident that you could look it up online, see if it's still there. And I'm like crossing my fingers that maybe there's some sort of digital paper trail of those programs that are there. And if not, Michael, maybe that might be a good next job for me, huh?
Michael, it looks like it is still there. And their tagline I really love is Unidos por las Aves, or United Through Birds.
Yes.
So Michael, yeah, go check it out. Other folks, if you're interested too. Bridget, you've brought with you
yes.
a reading
okay.
for us today, a poem.
Yeah, so we mentioned at the top of the show about sparrows, and I think sparrows are just such this great opportunity during this time of year because they're low, they're to the ground, they're staying in touch with one another, they're moving together across the landscape. And I have a love for poetry when I'm on my sit spot outside. So sometimes in order to disengage my brain from like that default mode that I'm in, whether it's like running through what I need to do next as a mom or what I need to do next as an executive director, poems can help ground me in the space and help me connect with the land. So I'd love to read, this is a little really different for us, but I'd love to read a poem from Sparrow Envy, Field Guide to Birds and Lesser Beasts by J. Drew Lanham. And for me, it really speaks to not only my love of sparrows, but also this time of year and how challenging it can be for some people. And so I'm hoping maybe folks can listen to this and find that connection to how birds can provide us some peace and solace and respite when we choose to interact with them, even as we go into this kind of darker time of year.
Mm.
Okay, so this one's called Sparrow Envy. Were I the sparrow, brown back, skittish and small, I would find haven in thorniest thickets, search far and wide for fields, lane, fallow, treasure the unkempt, worship the unmown, covet the weed-strewn row. I would slink between sedges, chip unseen from brambles, skulk deep within hedges, and desire the ditches grown wild. I would find great joy in the mist-sodden morning, sing humble pleas from the highest weeds, and plead for the gray days to stay.
Hmm.
So I know that transition can sometimes be hard, and I hear from people that, right, the temperature dropped a lot yesterday, and suddenly we're like, oh, it's going to get cold, the leaves are going to drop, we're going to move into stick season. And for me, my practice with birds also helps me kind of refresh and stay healthy mentally, right? And sparrows are such a joyous, small being that have all of these characteristics and qualities that kind of not only help me connect, but find that joy in this, what can be for some folks, a dark time of year. And so I would encourage people to embrace some poetry first. Embrace the gray days and maybe allow our connection with birds, especially sparrows, maybe ducks, maybe these large raptors flying over, to help us find that peace and that beauty even when it gets a little bit darker.
Mm. Thank you so much for sharing that. That one really
caught
me.
That's a good one,
Yeah. And that line, treasure the what is it? Treasure the unkempt?
Treasure the unkempt.
No.
Worship the unmown.
Mm.
Covet the weed-strewn row. Yeah, there's a lot of stanzas in that to kind of sit with. It's a nice thing to take with you. So this book is called Sparrow Envy, Field Guide to Birds and Lesser Beasts by J. Drew Lanham. It's small and pocket-sized, so you can shove it in your backpack and take it with you outside whenever you need to reconnect.
And I know we're not supposed to judge books by their covers, but it's a beautiful cover.
Yeah, it really is.
It's lovely. Thank you for sharing that.
You got it.
I want to ask you next about a bird that gives me a lot of peace to watch, and that is loons. I'm curious about their migratory patterns. And we also got a question from a listener who called in and had a tough phone connection. But Anne had asked about the sound of loons and if they can sound like howling wolves.
Oh, I don't doubt that at all. So if you're hearing, right, if you're near lakes, I don't know if I can imitate loons today. That's not one that's in my repertoire yet, but maybe I'll work on that for the spring
show. Spring.
But I think, so Vermont Center for Eco Studies has a really amazing program where they have folks that are basically like loon watchers for the summer to see where they are on different bodies of water, care for them, make sure that their nesting platforms aren't disturbed or put out.
That needs to be my next job.
Yeah, nesting platforms. Yeah, and be your job this afternoon is to go out and make sure the loons are okay. But they also have this really great pamphlet that has some descriptions in it about the different behaviors and vocalizations that we can hear from loons and what they mean. And so I think the listener that was trying to call in might check that out and see if they can find some different sound files online. I would go to All About Birds, which is run by Cornell, and look up common loon and listen to some of the variety. Now, if you have the free Merlin app as well, you can go on to that and you can not only listen to the vocalizations, but you'll also be able to see the audio sonogram. And for some people...
Oh, you're speaking my language
now. All right, right? Who are visual learners, right? This is really powerful to be able to not only hear it auditorily, but also visually connect with what you're hearing. And so I don't doubt that there are a couple of vocalizations for loons that you might hear that sound like a wolf.
Mm. All right. Come spring, Bridget. We're going to expect a loon call.
All right, I'll get on it.
In the Vermont Edition studio. Let's bring in some more callers. Julie has been waiting patiently on the line in Fairfax. Julie, go ahead.
Hi, Michaela. Hi, Bridget. I'm glad I could you could take my call. Yeah. I wanted to let the audience know about some really great birding events that are going to be happening this weekend at the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge.
Oh, do tell.
Saturday is actually October Big Day, and it's also the Big Sit. So the Big Sit is an event that started with the New Haven Birding Club down in Connecticut that the Friends of Missisquoi have been putting on for many years now. And basically, it's a big sit spot, a 17-foot diameter area that we stay in and bird for 12 hours straight from 6 in the morning to 6 in the evening and see what we can find. We usually get around 40 different species, but we are stationary. So the birds, they're really good about just carrying on naturally.
Yeah.
And we're not disturbing them. They're just doing what birds do. A lot of them are migrating through. A lot of sparrows that we've been talking about can be found. Mm. And it's a really great opportunity. You know, Vermont is blessed with an excellent birding community. And it's a really great opportunity to connect with some of those people that know, like Bridget does, know a lot about birds and be able to ask questions and get some help with bird ID.
Julie, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are you going to bring snacks?
I am, yes, we are bringing snacks.
So I know Julie, and Julie makes the most amazing cookies that are shaped like birds. So I'm...
All right, well, you put me on the spot. Now I have to make cookies tomorrow.
Julie, thank you so much for calling in. Bridget, I know you are a big fan of the Big Sit.
Yeah, the Big Sit, and then I think the other program that Julie was going to mention at the Wildlife Refuge, so you can check out Friends of Missisquoi Wildlife Refuge. They have a website. They have another event that's on Sunday. It's all day, and it's a walk for the wild, but it's not just going to be a walk. It's going to be like a 5K walk, then there's a 5K bird walk, and then there's a 5K paddle. Mm. And then they have a whole bunch of presenters that are coming to talk about all different topics. I'll be there talking about water quality, but we'll have folks, they'll have folks from the Vermont Center for Eco Studies talking about grassland birds. And then the refuge director is also going to talk about the history of the wildlife refuge. And they have these events all throughout the day. There's going to be vendors there, all kinds of cool things. So if you haven't been to this really amazing wildlife refuge in the northwestern part of the state, it's definitely worth the day trip up there.
Mm. Great. Well, thanks, Julie, for calling in. Sorry you have to bake cookies now that you're on the record saying you would.
Sorry, Julie.
I don't think Bridget's that sorry. Let's take one more call here. Tom in Stowe is on the line. And if you have questions about birdie, maybe a bird you saw recently, you need some help IDing it, 800-639-2211 is our number. Tom in Stowe, go ahead.
Hi. Yes.
Hey.
Kind of. Give it a shot.
Okay. Yeah, I was at the Lamoille Union High School midsummer, and I saw a pair of Merlins there, and they were there for about a month or so. And I'm wondering if that's a common thing for Merlins to be in that area.
Mm, Merlins in the Hyde Park Lamoille Union High School area.
Yeah, area. So we have these. So Merlins are a small falcon, right? So some of us are more familiar with kestrels that we tend to see across the agricultural landscape here in Vermont. So Merlins are very similar to that bird. We do have Merlins here that nest in Vermont. We actually have a pair where I live in St. Albans City. One of the best ways that you can find out if birds are being seen and spotted in your region is to get on Vermont eBird. And so this is a website where birders upload their sightings, and you can actually there's an explore function. And when you go to that explore function, there's a place where you can type in the species you're interested in, and then you're going to put Vermont, and a map will pop up. And it's got all these little pinpoints on it of where people have seen Merlin. And often that's for data going back even up to 100 years. So we've put historical records in there as well. But you can change the date range if you want and say how many Merlins were seen in the state of Vermont just, you know, during the summer months. And you'll get little pinpoints all across the state that show you where we have Merlins.
Ooh, yes. Amazing. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Tom. Glad we got to answer that question. One more real quick email question before we have to take another break. Larry emailed and said bluebirds are still present in the Barrie area where in the past they had migrated by now. Mm-hmm. Are bluebirds residing longer across Vermont, and has climate change affected that?
Yeah, I think so. This is a bird that we tend to see shift. They're a short distance migrant. We see them shift into the Champlain Valley a little bit more. So if you're in Barrie, those guys may be headed south. But we do have them year-round here in Vermont. And I do believe like this is going to be one of those species that already has the ability to stay here throughout the winter. And as we see milder winters, we're probably going to see them showing up in different spots. Again, Vermont eBird is another great resource to kind of make those comparisons between different times of year to see when birds are arriving or departing.
Bridget, one piece of birdie news that caught my eye recently was the story that NPR did about the American Ornithological Society, which recently held its annual meeting. And there was all this discussion about plans to change more than 100, I think, potentially offensive bird names. And the announcement, which initially came out last year, it stirred a lot of controversy among birders. What have you heard about this debate?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk about this over, I would say, since George Floyd was murdered, actually, as we started to think a little bit more deeply about racism and systemic racism and how that's reflected in our own birding community, we started to dig a little bit deeper into these people that we kind of put on pedestals and honor, right? So these bird names are, let me see if I can say this the right way, eponymous, there we go, eponymous or honorific names, right? So things like McGowan's Longspur or Wilson's Warbler. So these birds, their common names reflect honoring somebody in the field of ornithology. And as we get into the stories, as some folks started to research the stories of these people, including John James Audubon, we found out that they had some questionable values and behaviors that we some of us don't want reflected within the birding community anymore. And we started to listen to folks who say this affects their ability to feel included within the birding community, a sense of belonging. And so there were a number of people who started to speak up about this and write about this, including a number of Black birders across the country. And a lot of us started to listen deeply to those stories and reflect on our own experiences of belonging and began to practice what I kind of call compassionate kindness, which is really thinking, trying to put ourselves in that person's place. Maybe we don't completely understand their experience and why something that seems as simple as a bird name could be harmful. But as you listen to those stories and think about how we all want to belong and have a community to belong to, this birding community, we can start to practice some kindness around that. And so a group form called Bird Names for Birds and started to push the AOS to talk about changing some of these names. And so I think it's a really good thing on a number of different levels. You know, one, I want birding to be more inclusive to everyone. And so if there is a barrier to your participation because of a way that you perceive a word or a name being used, I want to know about that and I want to see if there's something that we can change. I'm really proud of the fact that the AOS and Bird Names for Birds first pushed back on this and kept pushing the AOS to make some of these changes. And now the AOS is moving towards that. So I would encourage folks to read up as much as they can about it, Bird Names for Birds. I know another thing that's starting to happen in the state here is a number of our Audubon chapters are starting to talk about and explore changing the Audubon chapter name to get away from that. The story and the history of Audubon. And then the other piece to this that I think is really also equally important is when we use bird names for birds, it also helps us be more inclusive in the sense that if I say to you, oh, there's a Wilson's warbler in the bush over there, that's not super helpful. And
you have no idea what you mean.
You have no idea. But if I said there is a black-capped yellow warbler in the bush over there, it's a little bit tinier than a chickadee, Michaela. It's got a black cap and it's yellow, just like its name, right? Yeah. Like black cap chickadee, right? That helps people connect with that bird in a different way than an honorific name. So we're kind of coming at this from two angles of trying to create a more inclusive community where everybody can feel like they belong and that they're safe.
That's a really helpful explanation. Yeah. And I'm curious to hear from our listeners, too, if this is something you've been considering, if you're part of the birding community. Maybe it's a topic that we can return to here on Vermont Edition. So send us an email if what Bridget was saying. Just hit you in any sort of way, vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Let's take a couple more calls
here. Let's do it.
All right, Nick in Waterbury is calling in. Nick, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Michaela. Hi, Bridget.
Hey.
I'm kind of mildly interested in birds myself, but my son, who's 2.5, absolutely loves them and constantly reads Peterson guides learning about birds. I'm curious kind of how you think the best way to get out there in the real world with him would be in an exercise that usually requires patience and focus.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple things that I have three kids. I mean, they're all teenagers now, so they don't want to talk about birds much. But when they were younger, one of the simplest things that I did is I had a really very basic poster of birds that I kept by the window and small little binoculars that the kids could use. Now, 2.5, right, they're not going to be using binoculars at that point. But I think just walking in different habitats and being able to allow kids that age, especially to engage the senses, feel, touch, smell, listening, right? So if you can find places where there are birds vocalizing and just pause and be together in that moment. The other thing that I love are the Audubon plush birds. They're all like the same shape. They're all these little squatty plush birds but the plumage is close to what you would see right in real life. And they have these little audio boxes in them. So when you squeeze the bird, one of the most prevalent songs for that bird will play. And I use those all the time with my kids when they were younger. And I can see this kind of experience through those plush bird scaffolding, right? So as a two-year-old, it might just be squeezing it and playing with it and obviously like sticking it in your mouth too, right? Because that's what little kids do. But as they get older, this is something that you could stick outside on a fence post and practice using binoculars with, or you can pair with a really simple field guide and match the birds to the pictures in the books that you're looking at together. Oh. Thank you so much.
That's
for
a
that
great
call.
Thank you so much, Nick. Those are I'm going to take those home with me too, Bridget. Thank you. We got an email from Jacob in Cambridge who writes that they have a mystery bird singing in their area, but haven't gotten binoculars on it yet. It sings when it's about 30 feet up in the trees, and Merlin can't identify it either. Sounds like a practicing cardinal, but going off script, they say. And we actually have a clip of this bird singing, so let's play that now.
Okay, I love the sound clip because you've got the chickens in the floor right up front. I was like, okay, that's a chicken.
And then, buddy, that's a cardinal.
And then you hear like the cars in the background, right? So you have to listen through all those layers. And then you hear truly, 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 truly. So I think you've got a little wren in the backyard there, maybe a Carolina wren. That's singing in the backyard. Someone else mentioned wrens at the top of the show, and this is another great like fall, like shoulder season bird. And I love how they get vocal again during the fall, and their vocalizations are really different than the spring. So this is another way to kind of spend a little bit more time with one bird and kind of get to know their vocalizations throughout the year. Mm. Thanks for the audio clip.
Way I know, that was great. Jacob, good. You got wrens and chickens. All right, let's take another call. We have Ed in Montpelier. Ed, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. It's a very interesting event that I noticed years ago when I was, it was the month of October. It was already started getting cold, and I was sailing my boat on Lake Champlain, and I noticed ahead of me a pretty large flock of loons, about 40, all together in a congregation on the water, very unusually large congregation. And as I was sailing towards them, one of them broke off from the group and started swimming towards my boat very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And as it approached, it took another direction to trying to lead me off, and it pretended that it was wounded. Oh. It was dragging a wing in the water, and of course, fool that I was, I went after them. I figured he's doing his job to protect the group from me.
Yeah.
So I followed him, and he got far enough away so that he felt safe to regain his health and rejoin his tribe.
Oh wow, that's awesome.
I figured they were on their way south.
Yeah.
So that's why there was such a large congregation of them.
Yeah, so here's what's interesting about loons, and I love that you brought this up, that there's like this large flock. When we see large groups of birds on the water, sometimes we call them a raft, right? Because it's like this huge raft. I live up in St. Albans, and on St. Albans Bay, we see this seasonally during the fall. And what it is, right, all the birds are starting to stage. And so they're leaving the smaller lakes, inland lakes, and things like that, to the west of us, coming to Lake Champlain, to that larger body of water, kind of grouping up together to then move out to the coast. So it's not really, so birds do migration in a bunch of different directions, right? So we have the ones coming down from the north that are going to hang out here. We have ones that are leaving Vermont and going south. But then we have other birds that migrate and move like from east west. And a lot of times that's for birds that are going from like inland lakes to coastal regions for for the wintertime. And that's what our loons do, is they stage on these bigger bodies of water. They're going to leapfrog, like use each of those lakes on the way out to the coast as like little lily pads to jump to. And then they'll be hanging out in the ocean for the wintertime and make their way back to the inland lakes for breeding season once again. So cool.
Thank you so much for calling in, Ed. I love any loon news.
It's reminding me about all the things that I need to get out there and go enjoy right now, you guys. Thank you so much.
I know, there's a lot to do. Okay, we have time for one more call, and then we'll release you to the wilds. David in Richmond. David, go ahead.
Hi. A few years back, I was in a production of Victor Victoria with Bridget. And I got to tell you, she sings like a bird. She's not only a bird diva because of her bird knowledge, but because of her voice. And she stole the show.
Oh, man.
It was so much fun.
Oh.
I'm sure she remembers it quite well also.
Thank you.
My wife and daughter and I sing with the Burlington Choral Society. And on the Saturday, the 18th of November, we're going to have a concert at the Ellie Long Center. And it's called Birding to Change the World. It's the title of a book by one of our singers, Trish, and I'm sorry, I forget her last name.
Trish O'Kane.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much, David, for calling in. What an apt show to talk about.
Okay, so, he's bringing up my theater background. Wow, that goes way back. I won't tell you what role I played. I looked very different back then. So Trish O'Kane's book, Birding to Change the World, is really amazing. She's over at UVM. She works with college students and pairs them with kids in local elementary schools to get them out on the landscape and connecting with birds. And Trish loves to sing, too, just like I do.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Aww.
So good.
Well, thank you so much for calling in and letting us know about that performance at the Ellie Long Center. One last email here before we have to go. John emailed to write, "We've been living here for 35 years, and cedar or bohemian, not sure which, waxwings appear in August and delight us with their gregarious antics. Mm. They're very curious and would fly very close to us, swooping down from the trees to tall weeds by our pond. Whenever I would mow, they would appear and grab various insects that were stirred up by the mowing. We always look forward to their appearance, but this year we haven't seen any. Any ideas why? We live in Tynmouth, a mountain town."
Yeah. So I love this. Both cedar and bohemian waxwings are nomadic, which means they're going to respond to food sources and food availability. He said he didn't know the difference between the two. Here's the cue. You got to look at their butts, their underbutts.
Bridget.
Yes, right? So we look at butts all the time on birds, right? That hairier, the upper butt has that white patch. Bohemian waxwings have a deep, rusty, like maroon, rusty underbutt. It's that kind of triangular patch between where the body and the tail starts, that kind of spot. Cedar waxwings are going to be white. So that's a really great way to distinguish between the two. And both these species move and shift depending on fruit availability. So when we keep native plants like pin cherries and mountain ash and dogwood and viburnum on the landscape, then we tend to see more of those birds around. When those trees or species get outcompeted by invasives or non-natives or just age out on the landscape, then the waxwings are going to move elsewhere.
Mm. Well, I can't think of a better subject to end on than upper butts and underbutts.
There we go.
Bridget, thank you for bringing us there.
You got it. My pleasure, always.